Okay, welcome to the Finnish Housing First Development Network podcast episode number 6. And I think today we have a kind of special episode for you guys who are listening, don't you think, Juha?
Yeah, very special. We have the honor of having the father of Housing First as our guest today. Welcome, Mr. Sam Cembaris.
Hi, nice to be with you.
You are in Los Angeles right now.
I am in Los Angeles. Los Angeles, California happens to be the most people who are homeless on the streets city of the USA.
Okay. But you started your work on homelessness in New York, on the other side of the country.
Yes. I started working in homelessness. Actually, this is August. We're having this conversation, and I remember very well the start date of my job in the Project HELP, which was the Homeless Emergency Liaison Project for the city of New York. It was a high-profile job. I had to interview someone from the mayor's office, and I had to meet the mayor because it was the mayor's idea, Mayor Ed Koch, that we needed to have some emergency program in New York City, because at that time there were some 12 or 14,000 people on the streets, many of them with severe mental illness, and about 30%, 50%. And some people were dying. People were dying because they would go into the subway to stay warm. They would get hit by a train or electrocuted by the third wire. People were freezing to death. And it was the mayor's idea that we needed a program that would focus on people who were homeless, but also possibly a danger to themselves or others because of their mental illness. And my start date at that program was August 8th, 1988. It was an easy date to remember. It was a date you had to use every time you had to fill out a form at the hospital. So it's kind of burnt into my mind that way. So that was about, sad to say, some 32 years ago.
Yeah, that's a long time, I would say. If you look back to that time, 1988, and you work at the New York City in a high-profile job, how did you come up with the Housing First a couple of years later? What was the thing that, you know, got you moving and going forward to the Housing First?
Yeah, that's a great question, because, I mean, I think there was no preconceived idea. When I first started, I was on a big learning curve. You know, there was I had worked with people who were severely mentally ill inside the hospital, but this was now on the streets. And you know, my focus was really to people's wellness. And so we would interview people with the idea of making sure that they were going to be well enough to survive on the streets. It was early in the days of homeless services. So if people were hungry, we might be able to recommend a food program. And of course, we always suggested that they go to the shelter or maybe something like a drop-in center. But because there were so few services, they were all of the homeless services were incredibly filled with people, you know. The shelters at that time was not unusual to have a shelter of 500, 800, 1,000 beds. You know, the shelter in Fort Washington up by Columbia University on the Upper West Side had a 1,000-bed shelter. It was an armory.
1,000?
1,000, yeah. It was a place. They had converted armories, you know, where the military would practice maneuvers. And they had closed down the armories and converted them into shelters. And these were terrible places. I mean, they had little metal beds right next to each other. I don't even think they met the United Nations refugee standards, you know, for a refugee camp. It was really overcrowded conditions. And at that time, just like now, there was an epidemic of tuberculosis. So crowded conditions was not a good idea even then, you know. But mostly it was the fear of being in such a crowded place that really was something that was unbearable for people, especially with mental illness, who tended to be more timid or afraid or withdrawn. That was not really an option for them. So they politely refused our offers and stayed on the street, except when they were perhaps sick, if they were coughing and there was blood coming up, or if there was their feet were very swollen, or we didn't think they would survive the cold because they were sitting, you know, too extreme outside and exposed to conditions, we would take people to the hospital. And that was the job. That was the job. But the idea that someone like this would be ready for housing did not occur to us. It wasn't even part of the conversation. The conversation was, will they survive or will they not survive? Do we have to take them to the hospital, or can we suggest a shelter for them? You know, it was very much, is there a relative perhaps we can call? Most people didn't have connection. So the housing idea was, I had the same idea that everybody else had when I started. The idea, I thought, was let's get these people in treatment. Let's get them some stability. Perhaps they can find a place like a group home. And over time, they would collect themselves and be in a position where they can handle a place of their own. There were no programs that had direct access into housing at that time. So that was, you know, that was the program. Housing was not part of the equation. But after a while, you know, and this took me two years at least to start to notice the pattern in the program, which is after people were in the hospital, if some of them were able to be referred somewhere else, I never saw them again because they went to the next place. But many people that we took to the hospital were back on the street. And then we take them again to the hospital 6 months later because they would deteriorate and they were back on the street. So it was this repetition, this pattern of doing the same thing over and over again that quickly became a signal that, you know, this is there's something wrong with this story here, because what we're doing is just running around in circles.
Yeah, that sounds like it. Like a revolving door. So
yes,
people,
yes.
People are coming in and then they're going out.
It's exactly. A lot of the papers in mental health services were called the revolving door at that time, by the way, because you know, because of the way, you know, people were going in and out of the hospital so quickly, you didn't even have time for hinges, just like keep spinning them around, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. But now, when you look back to the 1990s and now it's 2020, did you knew back then that this is going to be one of the most look after innovations in the social field and homelessness field that's going to carry on and take over the homeless services in the whole world, not just United States, but in the whole world?
Yeah, that, no, definitely was not. It was not part of the even imagined, I have to say. If there's one connection, I remember when we wanted to do something about this revolving door, what we did was we didn't do anything about housing. You know, it gets to, you know, were we trying to end homelessness or were we trying to help people with severe mental illness? The approach that we took was really to help people with severe mental illness make the best choices for themselves, because clearly the choices that we were making for them were not working. So we didn't really go, I mean, we didn't know where we would go, but we knew for sure that we weren't going there ourselves. We were not going to lead the way. We were going to facilitate the move, the next move. And when I fully appreciated what we were about to do, because, you know, I had been studying not housing or homelessness, I had been studying mental health. And in the history of mental health, there were very few programs that, if any, that invited people to make people with severe mental illness, you know, people with schizophrenia, we're talking about people with bipolar illness, you know, people with severe spectrum problems, as we call them, diagnoses, not that they're worth much, but just as a way to describe, you know, the group that I'm talking about, people that traditionally have been thought to be incapable of making competent decisions or even to go to court for themselves. You know, the idea of competency was separated from the idea of severe mental illness. Usually a judge would put a guardian or, you know, like that to make those decisions. And here we were saying, no, we're going to try this new thing. We're going to try this rehabilitative approach and not the medical model, but a rehabilitation model where we're going to invite the person to make decisions that influence their lives themselves, and we will support them. And I thought to myself, even then when I learned that, I thought, you know, this could create a revolution, a revolution in practice. But I didn't have a, I understood the gravity of it, the enormity of it, but I had no picture of where it was going.
So you were working with people with mental illness. Can you recall a time or a moment when you realized that this could be, you know, valid to other homeless people too?
Well, that's an interesting question. I was aware that we were trying something with the people who were most vulnerable among the homeless. It was evident right from the start that if someone like this, someone who we were focused on, people with the mental illness, often they had addiction, they may have been drinking on the streets, they were in very poor health. You know, these were the people that everybody sees on the street. They were the most visible, and they appeared to be the most helpless as well. So it was clear to me that if we can help someone like this, then everybody else who is obviously better functioning, quote unquote, can be helped by this intervention. You know, because, you know, it's like, it was evident. So yes. But I was also aware that governments and funding, at least, you know, in countries like the United States, where you don't have a national health plan and you don't have very much of a social safety net, that the reason we were able to get funding to start the first Housing First program was because we made an argument to the government that said, look, these people, they're going into the hospital, you know, for a month, sometimes 2 months. Even then, the hospital was $1,500 a day. So in one day, we had spent $45,000, you know, as taxpayers to put people in Bellevue Psychiatric Hospital, only to be discharged back to the street by through observation. You know, if somebody who has so many challenges can make it in a program like this, then obviously people with fewer challenges would make it even better. With $45,000, at that time, you could pay somebody's rent for 3.5 years, you know, and, you know, of course, you need money to look after them, you know, with the health services. But we already had the health services in place anyway. We were just doing outreach and following people around. The health services could be better utilized and have a better outcome if the person wasn't moving around the city wherever the police would chase them or wherever they felt it would be safe, but they were in a home and we could visit them and offer them the treatment in their home. So we had to make the cost argument just for this group. So it was very difficult to imagine the kind of cost argument for people that didn't have these challenges, for the general homeless population that were just poor. You know, even though there are cost arguments to be made, it wasn't the population I was working with, and people wouldn't, you know, it wasn't something that would be easy to convince the government of.
Yeah, that's very interesting point. And of course, you always have to show the numbers to make it seem like it's a good deal also to the decision makers as well. And that's very important as well. But how do you see that we talk about people with complex needs and multiple problems in their lives, and they get a home in scattered housing? How do you do the social integration, that those people who get the flats, you know, they integrate to the neighborhood and the area that they're going to move? Is there some methods or some practices that you are doing to make the social integration as good as possible?
Well, you know, the social integration, interestingly, was designed into the program because, remember, it was people themselves that were helping us to basically make the decisions about the program. So when we asked people, okay, you know, we're going to do things differently, where would you like to live? They were not, particularly choosy. They would go anywhere where the housing was available. The only housing that was available were what they call single site buildings, like an apartment building, but with small rooms and with social workers in the building. And people had to be, you know, taking medication. They had to be clean and sober in order to get into these buildings. Well, that was not really what our group was doing. Many of the people didn't really think that mental illness was their problem. You know, homelessness was their problem. They just wanted a place to live. So in order for them to get a place to live, we had to separate the idea of treatment from the idea of housing, because that was the way that people experienced it. People wanted to live in a home. They didn't want to live in treatment in these group home settings. So one of the principles in Housing First, of the separation of housing and treatment, really came from honoring people's wishes of the kind of program they wanted to live in. They would say, hey, listen, I want to live in housing and maybe go to treatment. I don't want to live in treatment. So, okay, well, that would be a place, you know, rented from community landlords. You know, we don't have much social housing in the States, so it was like private landlords. And that's what people wanted. The other thing about the independent apartment was that people didn't want to be identified as living in a building where other homeless people with mental illness were living. The stigma of the mental illness was very, very acute. And everyone on the block knows this is a program building, and people did not want to be identified with that. So another reason for integrating people was because they wanted the anonymity, the dignity of their own privacy. They didn't want people to know about them just because their address pointed to them in a particular way. So the renting an apartment was kind of an invisible process. You were living in a building like everybody else. This was not something I would have thought of. I was quite nervous about the idea of helping people find an apartment in a building with no support services, because I too had been trained in the mental health business. And I thought, who's going to take care of these people in the middle of the night? What if they have an emergency? You know, and what about the other people in the building? Will they be safe? So that's where we introduced another dimension of the program, which was this on-call. You know, here's my number. You call me. You know, we didn't have cell phones at those early days. We had beepers, and then we had these mobile phones that we would, you know, eventually had that was made it easier. But we had a beeper, and we had to find the phone to make the call back. But we introduced many of the components of the Housing First program as it operates today all over. Like you said, but we introduced those components by working together with the people we were housing and designed the program collaboratively in a way that made sense to them and also made it acceptable to us, so that we were both monitoring both their choice and our comfort level with their safety and the safety of everybody else. So these are the kinds of things you had to put in place in order for people to give to give them maximum independence, two things had to happen. You had to redesign the service and housing situation to accommodate their choice, and you had to change the way services were provided so that you can be assured that the people that you're housing would be safe, the community would be safe, and they would have access to services when they needed them. So it was very much a co-constructed piece. And, you know, it was, the social integration is a value. People want to live in the community like everybody else. That was a very strong principle and preference of the people we were working with. And by being able to rent apartments in the community, that was automatically put in place, you know, this experiment of, can people with these conditions who had lived in group homes before manage independently, and can they be successful at it? You know, what's interesting about the social integration is that even though you never think of regular housing as a program, you know, the environmental effect where people live is very, very important. So if people are living in a big building with other people who are in the program, there is one culture in that building. You know, everyone knows each other. They're in the program. You know, it has a certain kind of familiarity, but it feels like a program and it lives like a program. When people are living in apartments of their own, it sounds like they're independent and away from everybody else, but that's not true. They are living with other people in the community. I mean, if you let go the definition of the word program for a minute and think about community, these people are living in a community like just like people who are living in the building with all of the people in the program, only their program, quote unquote, is different. It's like all other people, old people, young people, couples, families, and that's their program. And people react to that. They treat people in a very normalized way. They say good morning, it's their neighbor. They don't assume to know anything about them. There is greater privacy between the units, if you will. And there's also a sense of you're living in a kind of a normalized setting like everybody else.
Yeah, that was a great answer. Thank you very much for that. It's great to hear such a good words from the man himself, if I may say. I just want to take one thing you said that about the scattered housing and then the units. I think we can move on to the implementations of housing first in Europe and especially in Finland. What do you think about our model in case of housing first? Because we do have these supported housing units where we have from 30 to 100 people living in the same building. Of course, they have their own apartments and there is the staff available 24/7. How do you see that Finnish model comparing to the original model that you have created in the United States? Do you think that the Finnish model is housing first, or is it something else?
Well, I think that we'd have to ask people who are living in those buildings how they see it. To me, that's more, you know, that's the most important thing, that you want people to be satisfied with the result, and you want people not to leave the building. So, you know, I guess, it seems to me that in Europe, the idea of sort of clustering people who are poor all together, you know, the idea of social housing is, Los Angeles has a lot of helicopters. The police have a heavy helicopter activity here. I don't know if you heard that one going.
Yeah,
we heard it.
But but Europe and social housing has a very different tradition. You know, it's not really unusual for people to be clustered in these large buildings. I think it's a more normalized approach. You know, that way in Europe, I think more than it is in the States and in Canada in some ways. But I think that, you know, there's two different ways of approaching the solution to homelessness. And one is working with the individual who is homeless to help them design a program, including housing, that is the thing that they choose. Okay, that's sort of, let's call that the person-based approach to ending homelessness. Okay, and I think the thing that I've been describing is the person-based approach to ending homelessness. And it ends up often being in a scattered site apartment, but if the person wanted to live somewhere else, we would take them somewhere else. It's not my choice, it's their choice. Most people end up in apartments integrated into the community. Then there is the housing development-driven solution to ending homelessness. This is where people get together, planners, policymakers, funders, architects, and decide, hey, listen, we're in a situation in this community where we need a lot more affordable housing to house all these homeless people. And then they, you know, identify the land and they identify the projects and they build all of this housing, you know, tremendous contribution to the housing stock. And then people move into them and they have a choice between, you know, what unit is available, but it's not a person-centered approach. I would call that the housing-led approach or the housing-driven approach to ending homelessness, you know? So do you see what I mean? That there's a different way to go about it. You know, one is one by one individually, and the other is sort of more of a social or community or even national policy level where you create a lot more affordable housing. It's like basically a souped up social housing program, you know, except for the fact that people are not from all different walks of life. It's particularly focused on people who are homeless. But I understand you also have some of the buildings are integrated and people who are paying full rent are living next door to someone who's homeless. Is that also true, or am I just imagining that?
No, it's completely true. Yeah, most of the former homeless people, they are living in scattered housing in, you know, normal social housing buildings and so on. And of course, we have few of these units, especially in Helsinki, but few of them around other parts of Finland as well. But yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm saying that, you know, what you really need is a lot of housing, as much housing as you can get. I think for me, the most exciting thing about what Finland has accomplished is that, you know, they have taken this idea of housing first to scale in a way that other countries haven't. You know, the idea that they have, that the Y Foundation has acquired, developed, purchased, rehabilitated so many units of housing is brilliant, frankly, because there are so many more units available than there are homeless people, which on a large scale builds in the integration. You know, if you have 12,000 units and you only have 2,000 homeless people, then, you know, the other 10,000 are the integration, if you will, you know, from the whole big picture perspective. And so, you know, and the, you know, the other thing about it is that it shows that if you bring the housing to scale, I mean, I think what we showed in New York and what drives the movement to end homelessness are two things. One, we showed that people we never imagined could be housed effectively are in fact able to be housed. Everyone can be housed, even the most vulnerable, and certainly those who are less vulnerable than that. That there is no connection between psychopathology, if you will, or disability and ability to function. Those people on the street that looked so helpless, they were figuring out where it was safe to sleep at night, where they can get food, where it's safe. They had enormous skills. They had just, we were blind to seeing them. So, you know, the idea of a person who can manage a life out on the street was clearly hidden from us that they could live in an apartment. But in hindsight, it was so much easier when the bathroom is right down the hall and your bed is right there and you don't have to walk blocks and blocks away from one program to another to go to the bathroom in one place and sleep in another. Or where do you get your food? So now it's in the kitchen. You know, it's like it was a big eye-opening surprise, strangely, and a very gratifying one. So once you decide you're going to house everyone, then the question is, can you get enough housing up there quickly enough to do it. And also you have to have the supports. And the way that, the Y Foundation has the other NGO providing the support in most cases is also very consistent with that separation of housing and treatment that I talked about. So the housing is more normalized and people don't live in treatment, in many cases. So, and ultimately is it a good thing or a bad thing is always about the numbers and the effectiveness of it. If you're getting people off the street and if you're having, and they're remaining housed and they're beginning to improve their lives. I mean, I guess that's really the mark of success. Are we helping people out of homelessness? To me, is only step one. It's only step one, especially with the people I'm focused on. It's all about what happens after you're homeless. Ending homelessness is actually the easiest part of this. Dealing with addiction, dealing with poverty, dealing with unemployment, dealing with mental illness, those we don't really have the housing first answer for. We don't have anything that will fix those problems as quickly as housing fixes homelessness. But that's only step one. So we're working on figuring out what the rest of it looks like. What does recovery and social integration really look like? But now at least we have the opportunity to work on that as opposed to keeping people moving and going from hospital to street to shelter and so on, just wasting our time and our lives on a futile effort that doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah, you're right about that. In Finland, we have a quite good amount of social housing, and luckily Y Foundation is having about 17,000 flats, and about 7,000 of those are for homeless people. So in that case, in Finland, we have a quite good situation, like you said. But how do you feel about one of the critiques that comes to the housing first, that it cannot work, for example, in the UK and in the US, because there simply is lack of housing. There is not enough social housing, and there is not going to be enough social housing in the future because countries and cities are not building them anymore because all the land is going to the private landlords who are aiming for high profit.
I think, now we're getting to the structural problems. And I think that this idea that, there is no social housing, and the idea that the rents are too high and we're not going to be able to build enough housing in the US or in Canada in order to address this problem, saying that as if it's somehow a fact of nature is really a disservice to what drives those decisions. I started working in this a long time ago, but homelessness was not a part of the American landscape until Ronald Reagan in the 1980s came into power, and his administration and every administration, Republican and Democrat after that, have really moved America to a capitalist neoliberal system of government where they're restructuring, both politically and economically, everything towards privatization. Right now we're having a big battle sort of challenging democracy itself because Trump wants to privatize the post office. They want to privatize, they've already privatized the healthcare system. He's got an education secretary that wants to privatize the education system. So everything is moving towards defunding public education, public healthcare, public housing, and moving it to the private sector, for-profit sector. And so what happens in the United States is that things like education and healthcare that are fundamental and housing that are fundamental human rights in a lot of other countries, like in Finland, are privatized businesses here, only for those that can afford to pay for them. These are not natural disasters. This is a political and economic system under capitalism that is creating housing that's unaffordable because it's all privatized and a commodity. Hedge funds own housing now. It's not even private landlords. You have the entire Airbnb business where lots of affordable housing was taken over and fixed up, now rented for vacationers. Where have all those people been thrown out to? We have homelessness because housing has become unaffordable. The government under Reagan, prior to that, was building 350,000 units of social housing. We call it public housing in the States. And it went down to almost zero, 50,000, less than 50,000 for a country this size. And there's been no investment in social housing, only privatized. So people on disability benefits, because they have a mental illness, who are making a monthly benefit, do not have anywhere close to the money that they would need for the first month's rent and the first month's security to get into the private market housing. And all there is private market housing for the most part. So it's not a surprise that we have homelessness, and we have homelessness in Los Angeles and New York and Seattle and Portland, in the cities that are economically booming because the economics is bringing in more people, more jobs. They can afford to pay. Landlords are increasing rents because everything is privatized, not government controlled. And not surprisingly, in the cities that are the wealthiest, we have the biggest number of homeless people. Those things are absolutely connected. They're not accidental. There is an economic and political system of values that is creating homelessness at a much faster rate than there is an investment in social or affordable housing programs that can end it. So that's what we have going on in the States. And homelessness is not an individual problem, except that, we tend to describe it that way. The people we're talking about who are homeless are the victims of an economic and political system. And they are just the most vulnerable because they are not actively participating in the workforce. So that's, the fix to homelessness we know. The fix to homelessness we've known since 1992, just like put people in housing. And countries that have taken that approach and invested in it not only have fewer homeless people, like they've ended chronic homelessness. And so, it's not that we don't have the intervention here. We have the intervention. We have the evidence. So many studies now and so much data. But we don't have the political will to change things. And even in the recent political climate where you had people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren speaking about the income disparity, which is absolutely related to homelessness, because countries that have greater income disparity have more homeless people, they don't get to be the mainstream ticket. What we have instead is a more central, Biden and Kamala Harris ticket, which is at least two reasonable people compared to the catastrophe we've had in the last 4 years. So, which has really been a war. There's been a war on housing first in the United States. For the last year and a half, they appointed someone in charge of homelessness that says we have to go back to shelters, big shelters, put people in them, and then they have to prove that they're sober, they have to prove that they're healthy, they have to prove that they want to work in order for them to get housing. They're going backwards, back. So it's a dangerous moment for people who are vulnerable in this country. There's going to be a lot of pain and suffering if the election doesn't change the leadership in November. And I'm afraid that other countries then might follow suit, for the first time, at least here, this Housing First movement is being challenged or threatened.
Yeah, and let's sure hope that the next 4 years will be a little bit more brighter than the previous four ones. But you said that there has been some that people have been challenging the Housing First model. And I have to take on to that because last week we read this article from the Heritage Foundation. I think it was something like 24 pages long. And The title was that Housing First has failed in the United States.
And
they suggest that it should be treatment first.
Yeah.
Yeah. And all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I can really understand.
No,
the situation
it's really,
that you're going. It's
already beginning. You know, the Heritage Foundation is a right-wing conservative think tank.
Exactly. Yes.
And so they are beginning to amass the data. The data is actually accurate. They just are very clever in they're focusing on the fact that Housing First has not cured mental illness and has not cured addiction. But that was never the claim. You know, they quickly say that Housing First works to end homelessness, but they pretend as if that's nothing. And then they're focused on how Housing First has failed to treat mental illness and addiction. I mean, it does, you know, somewhat better, but it's not sold as a cure for mental illness and addiction. It's sold as a cure to end homelessness for people with mental illness and addiction so that we can get better outcomes with them or have a chance at treating them. Putting them into a shelter, we already have the data on that. We know that doesn't work. But, you know, these people are clever, you know, and they don't care much for the science. And they are just like with climate change, you know, it's no different. You know, they're refuting scientific findings on everything. So why not Housing First, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly my thoughts as well.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. If we move on to the next chapter that we have here, and it's about the Housing First model and into the sub models. And what we mean about the sub models is that there has been some Housing First for youth, for example, and Housing First for families and Housing First for ex offenders. How do you see these sub models? Because in a way, how we see it is that Housing First already covers all the people, and because you can, you know, tailor the services and etc.
Exactly. No, exactly. No, actually, it's a little. There's been a bit of an annoying overanalyzing of Housing First. You know, like, you know, Housing First light and Housing First heavy and Housing First for this, Housing First for youth. It's like it's all Housing First in my perspective, because fundamentally all of these programs are fundamentally the same. They're serving different populations, and so everybody needs the more or less the same type of housing. It would be housing of their choice. It usually looks the same, and the thing that you would adjust are, as you mentioned, the services. So for some people, you know, if you're housing people who are in their 40s or 50s or 60s and they have mental illness and addiction, you would need nurse, psychiatrist, social work. If it's a youth program, you would need someone that's all about jobs and education and, you know, other kinds of supports and not as intensive supports. There was already a very good study in the States by Beth Shin and others about called the Options Study, which looked at family homelessness. Family homelessness is primarily about poverty, so that they gave families a voucher, which is a rent subsidy, and families were able to go into these apartments with very little case management at all and managed to stay housed for, like, you know, ongoing. So,
yeah, we completely agree with you, and I think we are looking through the same lenses, I guess.
Yeah.
But okay. If we move to the 2020, and now we have the COVID-19 situation, and things are going pretty crazy at the moment all around the world.
Yeah.
And what at right now, this moment, what is needed to really end homelessness? Because there has been arguments that now really is the golden hour to end actually homelessness for good, because there is money, there seems to be money, and there seems to be will. But is there in different countries really a realistic plan how to do it? Or are we going to end up to the same old when the situation is over?
You know, that's a question that we discuss over beers, right?
Yeah.
Because who knows the answer to that? But I have to say, the COVID, what's been most interesting to me about the response to COVID is, you know, we collectively, you know, in the Housing First business have been saying forever, look, it's not good to leave people in shelters. You have to move them into a place of their own. It's safer. It's more decent. It's humane. And now COVID comes along, and suddenly, without any conversation, everyone is in agreement. You know, everyone is getting out of their shelters into a room of their own. There are all these hotels and motels going out of business. Everyone's getting a place of their own right away. No questions asked. The whole world has become housing first at this moment.
Yes.
It's like, oh, thank God for COVID. I mean, I don't really mean that, but, you know, it's kind of a strange and paradoxical thing, but it's kind of fantastic. And also, you know, this thing we were talking about earlier, these people who are saying, oh, put everybody in shelter and treatment first, they have gone silent. Where did they go? Suddenly their stupid idea doesn't seem so smart anymore. So they have gone away temporarily. No one's talking about big shelters anymore. And everyone is getting into these motels, thousands of people. I find three things interesting about that. One is that suddenly everyone has become a housing first person, not a treatment first. Two, the government that is paying for this is the disaster government. It's FEMA. It's not the usual, the housing agency and the health agency putting a little bit of money, you know, always too little for the size of the problem. Now they're moving up and they're saying, we're going to house in California, for example, we're going to house 20,000 people in these empty hotels, motels, 20,000. You know, usually, oh, we're building some supportive housing. We're going to house 100 people, you know? Like, now we're talking scale in a way that we've never talked scale before, because homeless people are threatening the capacity of emergency rooms that treat everybody. So if we don't take care of people who are homeless and they get ill, there won't be respirators for everybody else. So suddenly it's become important, you know, for all of us. So everyone's become housing first. The scale is what it should be. And people are moving off the streets quickly. What I worry about is that all of this is emergency money and emergency focused. And when we go back to more of business as usual and people begin to travel again and these hotels can be renting out, you know, at a different price to paying guests than the ones that are subsidized now, what will happen to the people in these hotels? Are they going to be evicted out onto the street just like rent payers are now when they're losing their job? And also, hotel room is not a home. So will they take a lesson from Finland? When you started converting the shelters into studio apartments, there are already projects in place here that are looking to convert hotels and motels into studio apartments, which would be a relatively reasonable renovation so that you can have that kind of a long-range plan. Right now, some of that is happening, but not nearly enough. So we are doing the right thing, I think, in terms of the emergency response, you know, more than less. But it doesn't, it worries me that there's no long-term plan for how we will, A, convert the hotels to actual homes or studio apartments, or B, how will we sustain people's rents, you know, once this emergency is over.
Yeah, I was thinking about the scale that in addition to these people who are placed in hotels right now, there will be a huge amount of evictions when the eviction ban is going to be ended. I guess it's in the early September.
They keep trying to move it forward, but it's a big problem. It just hangs. It hangs there all the time for people. When will they stop paying the when will they stop the eviction ban? And everyone's waiting for a tsunami of evictions. That's what we're afraid of.
And the kind of private market, which you described, that has been growing, I guess they are not very well prepared to tackle this this situation.
Right.
Yeah, because it was quite shocking thing to read. I think it was something they were making assumptions that there was going to be something like 20 to 40 million people to get evicted in the next, in the coming next 6 months in the United States alone. So that is a huge number of people. Those numbers are really going to end up to be realistic ones. So there's huge problems lying ahead, maybe. But hopefully there are going to be some solutions so that those people will not end up on the streets.
Well, you know, we do have solutions. We're not taking them. You know, just recently, because now is the time that the next year's budget goes in, and there was some debate about the Pentagon budget of they initially proposed $740 billion, and now it was down to 720 or 710. Wow. And so this is just the Pentagon, but it's like there is so much money in this country that $30 billion, you know, 10%, 15% of the Pentagon budget would cure all of these problems. No, you know, it's not like there's a lack of resources. It's a lack of political will to spend the resources in a way that benefits people. You know, it's a structural problem that we keep talking about the symptom. We're not talking about the structural problem. We're not talking about changing the tax base, bringing it back to where, you know, millionaires were paying 70 or 80% taxes on their income, where we had a middle class in this country, where the unions were being protected instead of dismantled. You know, all of these things were changed by politics, and politics in this country is driven by business, because even in the current campaign, it's all about how much is Trump raising and how much is Biden raising. And there's millions and millions and billions of dollars wasted on campaigns. I mean, so the whole value system, and of course, because the investors are buying their politicians like we buy products, the product has an obligation to the purchaser if they win. So, you know, and the purchaser, who are the mega captains of capitalism, are not interested in distributing their wealth in a way that benefits the many. So we have structural problems. And unless we actually talk about those problems, we're always going to have problems with homelessness, with education, with healthcare, because those are the symptoms of a dysfunctional societal system driven by a capitalist arrangement. And as long as we don't dismantle that, we'll always be in the social service business because we'll have so many social problems to take care of.
Okay, I think we could spend the whole night of dismantling capitalistic arrangements, but I'm afraid we have to kind of close it up now.
I have one more question.
Okay, please.
Because I'm a huge ice hockey fan, and I know that there are NHL playoffs going on right at the moment. I have to ask that, do you follow ice hockey, and is there a favorite team of yours still in the playoff games?
Oh, I haven't been following the playoffs. Are the I don't know if the Montreal Canadiens are part of the playoffs this year, but
they still are.
Okay, well, I have to start watching then. But I grew up in Canada, so hockey, you know, that's what you do. I still play hockey. I mean, I'm 71 years old. But I play on this old man's league.
And, oh, nice.
You know, just because it's a kind of a game, really, you could play lifelong. You know, it's easier than running, which I hate to do.
Yeah.
It's also easier on my knees, and it's a team sport. I'm a big hockey fan, and my heart belongs to the Montreal Canadiens. What can I say? You know, I have one funny hockey story, because now I live in the States. You know, I'm also an American citizen, and I was watching the Olympics with my daughter, who must have been maybe 12 at the time, and it was the finals between the United States and Canada. And it was such a close game. It was unbelievable. It was 3-3, and I think they went into overtime. And then Sid Crosby, who's from Halifax, a Canadian, even though he plays for an American team here, he was playing for Canada, scores the overtime goal. And I was screaming, like, I couldn't stop myself, even though I knew my daughter was rooting for the American team because she's, like, born here, you know? And she looked at me like I had betrayed her, and she said to me, "Why do you live here?"
Fair question.
True friends. Well,
I think that is excellent story to end this podcast episode. Mr. Sam Chambers, thank you very much for participating to this discussion. And like you have said, you know, this could have been going on for the whole night.
Thank you so much for inviting me. You guys are an inspiration to me, to the world, for what you've accomplished, an inspiration. And I thank you for your work and look forward to many more conversations.
Thank you.
And yeah, my name is Juha Kaihela, and this was the Housing First Development Network episode, podcast episode number 6.